Blog Talk Radio.
Slaves, Koran 929.
29 said so. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Red Fox Blogger with your hosts, Tim Burton and Kel Fritzy. I'm glad that you could join us both today. I am, well, in a deep freeze. It's freezing. Tim, I'm cold. We had a foot of snow.
A foot of snow. Oh, I dream of the days when we only had a foot of snow. Do you know how long it's taken me to dig a path from my front door to my car this morning? It's been that bad. In fact, I was lucky I still had a car. Couldn't see it underneath the snowdrift this morning. It was that bad.
Oh, my gosh, you too. Oh, the entire eastern seaboard is getting hit, and middle America is getting hit. Middle Canada is getting hit. It was really bad here. It was so bad that Mr. Kell was out there this morning, and I'm making his lunch for him and making his tea for him, and I'm looking out the front window, and that poor man, he had the broom with him. He was brooming off so that he could at least see his license plate on the car. It was just unbelievable. We don't live on a big lot by any stretch of the imagination, but we do have a lot of walk. He must have been out there for 30 minutes shoveling away just to dig himself so that he could get himself off to work. It was unreal, and I took over duties later on in the day. Unbelievable. The poor dog didn't know what to do. She goes out for her business, and where's my steps? It's really bad. Oh, but and I'm in the dungeon, but at least I'm warm in the dungeon. I'm not outside shoveling snow anymore. But Tim, how the devil are you?
Well, I'm not too bad at all, thank you, Kel. I was actually looking a couple of hours ago on the evening news here about the conditions in America in particular. I don't suppose it's too different from where you are at the moment, but there was a chap on the news. He said one of the coldest recorded days it's ever been. I think he pointed to a thermometer which said something like minus 22, which has got to be a bit on the nippy side. And just to demonstrate how cold it was, he took a cup of hot water and threw it up into the air, or threw the contents up into the air, and they had frozen before they hit the ground. That's how cold it was. And that was pretty impressive, because I know we complain about the weather here over in the good old United Kingdom, but that was pretty impressive. I don't think I've ever seen anything like that before. So, yes, our thoughts are with you on the eastern seaboard of the United States. It can't be a lot of fun, so keep wrapped up warm. In fact, they were interviewing people on the TV, and they were saying, what are your recommendations for when you go outside? And pretty much everybody said, make sure you're wrapped up warm, which I would have said myself was slightly on the obvious side, but, you know, it makes news over in the United States, so I suppose we shouldn't complain about that. It's been pretty cold here, but not as bad as over in the United States, and you sound like you're having a tough time of it, Kel. I'm surprised Mr. Kel didn't give it up as a bad job and phone in for a snow day if he's taken it all that time just to get the snow off his license plate. I can imagine
Before he left for work, I said, can you do me a solid and phone me when you get to work so that I know that you got there, because the roads were rather treacherous. And he usually gets there. It's a 20-25 minute drive. A 25 minute drive is a traffic jam. He's usually there within 20 minutes. And he left, and it's like, where is he? He's not calling me. He's not calling me. An hour later, the phone rings. Hi, I just got here. A 20 minute drive took him an hour to get there. That's how bad the roads were. It's like, oh boy.
Yeah. Well, we get the same sort of thing here when there's about an inch and a half of snow on the ground. Everything grinds to a halt because we're not really geared up for it like you are in North America and Canada. It only takes a little bit of snow on the ground and it's panic stations. The trains all grind to a halt, especially if there's the wrong kind of snow on the line. Apparently that causes chaos. We had that a few years ago where they had the previous year, they installed some very expensive snow equipment, or anti-snow equipment, I should say, on the rail network. And anyway, they had the first fall of snow of the winter, and everything ground to a halt. And of course, people were phoning up saying, what's going on? Because you had all, it was widely publicised, they had all this anti-snow equipment on the rail network. And the statement that came out from the rail network was, we do apologise, but it was the wrong kind of snow. So, you know, that's very important here in the UK. We can get into all sorts of trouble if we don't have the right kind of snow. But I imagine you're a bit more rough and ready in Canada for the worst of the weather, more prepared than we are, I should say.
Oh, yeah, we are. Being in North America, we have no choice but to be. It is, you know, and especially when we get what we call the Alberta Clippers, when they blow in, and that just devastatingly drops the temperature rather abruptly. And they are recording that. Tonight, ladies and gentlemen, if you are in the Ontario area or thereabouts, just be warned, it's going to be very, very, very cold tonight with the wind chill factor. And they are talking record drops in temperature tonight. So make sure that your pets are indoors. Make sure if you have to go out that you have the proper provisions. Make sure you stay safe, stay warm. And if you do not have to leave the house tonight, please don't. It's going to be a very unpleasant night.
Yeah, that's good advice, Kel. And I remember over here we routinely forget to do all these things because we're not used to the extremes of weather. And we had a very bad snowstorm. It was in the Midlands. I think it might have been 7 or 8 years ago, and it came in all of a sudden, and it trapped a lot of people overnight on the major motorways in the centre of the country. And I think there were quite a few fatalities, which could have easily have been avoided, I should say, if people had taken some basic precautions like a hot thermos flask of hot soup or a hot drink or something like that, and some food in the car and a shovel. Who thinks of putting a shovel in the car? But yeah, put a shovel in the car so you can dig yourself out of trouble if you have to. Basic things like that can save your life. So if you are going out, just remember. And when I tell you that over in the UK, everybody in the UK will be laughing and saying, it's never going to be that bad. But it can be that bad. We have had fatalities in the past through sudden flurries of snow that have settled into like 6-foot, 8-foot drifts. You probably don't need telling so much over in the United States and Canada, but nevertheless, it's worth repeating. It can't hurt, and if it saves one life, then, you know, that's good.
Absolutely. And that's what I mean, ladies and gentlemen. Like, do take the proper precautions. What are we talking about tonight, Tim?
Well, tonight, Kel, we are talking about Islamic prayer, believe it or not. And I was doing a little bit of research on that over the last couple of days, and I was thinking, how hard can this be? But in fact, when you start looking into it, it's quite involved. And there are all sorts of factors relating not only to the preparations leading up to the prayer and the various times of the prayers and the things that you have to do before a prayer can be considered to be valid. The prayers themselves, they're not all the same. They vary throughout the day. There's all sorts of factors that you wouldn't really, if you just think about prayer from a Christian point of view, it's relatively straightforward. in comparison. But Islamic prayer is really quite involved. So hopefully we'll be bringing you a few interesting little snippets for you to think about tonight. And the reason it's important, ladies and gentlemen, amongst other things, is the content of the prayer. We'll be telling you a little bit about what Muslims are actually doing when they pray, what they are saying, and the implications, because that's quite interesting too. Some of our listeners may already know this, but the content of the prayer does actually have implications for non-Muslims as well, and we'll be telling you about that a little later on.
It's interesting. I was trying to relate a story about the call to prayer, and that's the Adhan. And I was getting myself confused on Jeff's show yesterday because apparently there are quite a few references as to what exactly the call to prayer is. And I had seen, I have read about Adhan. I've also read about Aslam, and I don't, it gets a little confused sometimes,
yeah,
because they seem to have, it seems wherever you go, whether or not you're speaking Arabic or Farsi or whatever, they seem to have different reference points for what the call to prayer actually is. But for the sake of simplicity, I'm going to stick with Adhan.
Yeah, that's fair enough. We had a little chuckle yesterday because somebody on the EDL radio show referred to it as Aslan, and I thought, that's not right, because
that was me. That's what I mean. I was confused. Yes, I was getting them mixed up. I had a little. I did have a little chit sheet that I keep in front of me normally, and for goodness sake, I trust me to lose it at the exact wrong moment, and that's what I did. But
Well, it's just that Aslan is, of course, the fabled talking lion out of the book The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe by C.S. Lewis. So it's not to be confused with the Adhan, unless, of course, when you're referring to Aslan and then cross-reference it with Muslims, you got to say, well, they're probably lying about it whenever they tell you. So that's my little contribution for today. You could feel free to ignore that if you want, but it's important not to get them mixed up, because you'll offend talking lions everywhere if you do. So that is important.
And we cannot do that.
Indeed
and
not.
Aslan, I love Aslan. The Lion and the Witch in the Wardrobe, when I thought that he was going to die, I was watching the movie and I was literally crying. And so, no, I do not want to offend my favorite lion in the whole wide world.
Quite so. So I'm glad we got that cleared up. But, sorry to interrupt, Kel. You were talking about the different names for the call to prayer. And, of course, the prayers themselves actually have different names depending upon where in the world you are. Most Muslims would refer to the prayer as a salat, but I think it's the Persians refer to it as namaz, but it is basically the description of the same thing. And in different parts of the world there are some slight differences between them, but I say slight differences. We were talking last week about the various sects of Islam, or might have been the week before, but there are some variations in practice of prayer in between the various sects. The most common sect in terms of the number of adherents is, of course, Sunni Islam, and the prayer is slightly different if you look at Shia Islam and some of the other sects. And in fact, there are some minor differences even within Sunni Islam, but I don't know that we necessarily need to cover those tonight, because they're rather esoteric in as much as they don't have huge implications. I suppose the one difference I might say is that when it comes to Sunni Islam, the schools of law, or the madhabs in Sunni Islam, there's four major schools of jurisprudence, as our listeners probably know: the Hanbali, Shafi, Maliki, and the Hanafi schools of jurisprudence. And the Hanbali school of prudence holds that if you don't pray five times a day as a Muslim, then you are in fact a disbeliever. They're really quite strict about it, whereas the other three Sunni Islam schools of jurisprudence, the Shafi, Maliki and Hanafi, say that if you don't pray five times a day, you're merely a sinner rather than a disbeliever. Oh, well, that's all right then. But yeah, those that was one major difference that I discovered when I was doing some research, that even within the sects there are some differences, some less important than others, but I thought that was one that was worth mentioning of interest.
That is really interesting. I'm just having a little bit of a technical difficulty here, so my apologies for that, Tim. But okay. there is one thing that I did come across, and I found this rather interesting, in that if you go to any community in North America or in England or anywhere else, you go to a site, and it's called Islamic Finder. And in my particular community, they have the prayer schedule for the month of January. Very interesting. The Fajr, the Duhur, the Asr, the Maghrib, and the Isha, and those are the five prayers that they have to recite every day. They have the schedule. They have the date, the day, and they have the times. For example, the Fajr on January 1st of this year was at 6:28. On the 4th, it would be 6:29 a.m. On, say, the 14th coming up, on a Tuesday, it's going to be at 6:27 a.m. And same for the sunrise prayers. I mean, those are the sunrise prayers. The Duhur, 12:25. Another day, it might be 12:26. Another day, it might be 12:27, and that's noontime. And the Asr would be 2:38. Another day, 2:39. Another day, 2:40. Another day, 2:56. The Maghrib, that would take place maybe at 4:56 p.m., and another day 4:57 p.m., another day 5 p.m., another day 5:14 p.m., and the Isha, that's the supposed final prayer of the day, 6:22 p.m., 6:34 p.m., 6:37 p.m. Tim, I find this a little disconcerting. They are very strict about this.
They are precise because the prayers are supposed to be done. If you're a devout Muslim and you're going to stick to the correct times, the times of the prayers relate to the positions of the sun in the sky. So for the Fajr prayer, you're talking about sunrise, and obviously, depending exactly where in the world you are, sunrise and sunset are going to occur at different times, and noontime, you're looking at when the sun begins its downward trajectory. That's the idea. So the ones where you're going to see most variation, I suppose, are going to be the sunrise and sunset. But yes, they're all related to the position of the sun in the sky, which of course brings us to another interesting point, which is to say that for those Muslims who are who happen to live in the far north of the Arctic Circle, or the far south to the south of the Antarctic Circle, where you have periods of the year where the sun either never sets or never rises, that does pose a little bit of a difficulty. And there are other, well, with that particular one, I believe what they have to do is they have to go to a local imam and get advice locally as to when exactly to perform the prayers, because they can't do it in relation to the sun, because the sun is not going to be a guide if you've got 6 months of daylight and 6 months of or whatever the period of time is, 6 months of daylight, 6 months of night time. You're going to be able to calculate the right times for the prayers by the sun alone. So I think what they have to do there is to get a legal ruling on exactly when they pray, because they can't use the sun. But that's why you get the variations. And you're quite right, as you so rightly said, for a Muslim that lives in any particular city, all he has to do is to just go to that particular site, type in the name of the city, and the times will be given for him. And as long as he's able to stick to those times, everything's good. One of the other things, of course, that I'm reminded about, which I don't know, you may have been thinking of touching on this later, Kel, is that although these times are ideal times, if a Muslim is late practicing one or more of the prayers, that's not necessarily the end of the world as far as his relationship with Allah is concerned. He is allowed to make it up later. And that's something that does cause quite a bit of Western world when Muslims say they have to stop work and let their colleagues pick up the slack because they have to go off and perform their daily prayers. It leads to unnecessary resentment, as I'm sure you will know, Kel, and I'm sure some of our listeners will know, especially on production lines where it's having the right workers in place at exactly the right time for the different stages of production is important. It's quite difficult to accommodate Muslims who just want to break off whatever they happen to be doing to perform their daily prayers. But there isn't really the need for it because a Muslim can make them up later. And what we see is Muslims trying to assert their authority on the Western the Western world and the Western work practices. And it's not really to do with religious observance, it's to do with showing the kuffar who is boss. And that is something that people really need to bear in mind whenever a Muslim says, we have to do it this way because it's the Islamic way of doing it. You want to take that with a pinch of salt because it's not necessarily always true. It might just be that the Muslim wants to put his stamp of authority on whatever it is that the kuffar would prefer happened, and that's why we see what we do in, I think it was a meatpacking plant in particular where we first started to see this, somewhere in the United States or Canada. I seem to remember the name Swift coming to mind.
Yeah, that was one particular meatpacking plant, and I believe that was in Kansas, and that they were making quite a bit of noise about not being accommodated to acknowledge their daily prayers, their five daily prayers. And I had been discussing this a little while back. And they are, like you say, Tim, they are allowed to recite their prayers. As long as they get their five prayers in a day, they're fine. Maybe they can't make the midday prayer, for example. But they do go into the workforce. They say, look, I'm a Muslim, and you have to respect my religious beliefs, and I'm going to pray, whether you like it or not, but they don't really have to. I was reciting that article, the rigidity of when they have to pray or what times they have to pray, but it is not written in stone. They do not have to disrupt the workplace, but they do it because of their hubris. Like, which amazes me. Like, the arrogance of this particular religion just knows no bounds.
Well, it's all part of a pattern, of course. And if we might digress from just the prayers for a moment, I'm sure our listeners are going to be aware that these patterns repeat themselves over and over in every Western country where the population of Muslims has grown to a critical point, and the critical point might only be 2 or 3% of the population. We have discussed this before, but it's worth mentioning again that it's quite easy to divine roughly what the percentage of Muslims in a population is by the behaviour that they adopt by and large when they're interacting with that host population. There's been a study by a chap called Dr. Peter Hammond that I post regularly on my Twitter feed, and there have been other studies that have been done that pretty much back this up, and they all come to the same conclusions, which is to say, when Muslims are about 1% of the host population, nobody really minds. They're not overly assertive. There seemed to be a colourful ethnic group adding to the rich multicultural diversity and rainbow makeup of the Western country in question. Nobody really minds, but once they start becoming more populous in the host population, then you start to see a paradigm shift in their behaviour towards non-Muslims and the way in which they interact with non-Muslim individuals, groups and organisations. And when they get to be about 2 or 3%, then yes, you start to see them flexing their muscle, and that's one of the ways that they do it. Of course, once you start getting above 2 or 3%, you get all manner of other problems creeping in, which I won't go into now, but it is a good indicator of how many Muslims you have in a particular country or a particular area. You can just look at what they are doing and match that up to the patterns that you might expect for particular populations. It's an unfortunate thing. But there it is. That's yeah, the way that we are. And we ought to be responding accordingly and making them aware that such behaviour is not welcome. And, in fact, it ought to be strictly controlled. But I think we're a little while away from that at the moment. But the first thing to do is just to make people aware that that is what is happening. And it's predictable. You can take these patterns and look at them pretty much in any Western country and see that the behaviour of Muslims conforms fairly closely to the percentage of the number of Muslims in the host population.
And that's another thing too, is that the premise of the topic for today is the call to prayer, and what exactly does the call to prayer entail, and what exactly are the Islamists praying for? I've had this conversation with people in the past, Tim, in which a lot of Muslims, there's a very high percentage that do not understand Arabic, and they do pray by rote. Do they even know what they're saying, and what are in these prayers? Now, I was reading this article here, and it's entitled How Muslims Pray and What They Say. There is a call that is made from the mosque, and of course that is the adhan, and that indicates the time of day for which they pray. That's obligatory prayer. Okay, we've got that. There are 5 obligatory prayers a day. Yes, we understand that. On hearing the call, people start preparing themselves for the prayer. We understand that. But appearing below is a transliteration and translation of what a caller to the prayer says. And he starts out as, Allah Akbar, Allah Akbar. God is greatest, God is greatest. Ashhadu alla ilaha illallah. I bear witness that there is none worthy of worship but God. Ashhadu an la ilaha illallah. I bear witness that there is none worthy of worship but God. Ashhadu anna Muhammadan Rasulah. It bears witness that Muhammad is the prophet of God. Ashhadu anna Muhammadan Rasulah. I bear witness that Muhammad is the prophet of God. They repeat these quite a few times. They repeat, Halia ala salah, come to prayer. Halia ala salah, come to prayer. They do that a few times. Alua Akbar, Alua Akbar, God is great. God is greatest, God is greatest. La ila al ula, there is no deity but God. But what are they praying for? Like, who do they pray to? They pray to the one God without associating any partners with him. They pray facing the holy mosque in the city of Mecca. Facing the mosque is simply for uniformity and homogeneity in the prayers of all Muslims around the world, and not as an act of worship to the mosque itself. But what do they say and do? Muslims stand before their God by making the intention to pray, leaving all other chores and concerns aside. And we touched upon that there at the beginning, Tim, about what they're doing in the workforce in the West, for example. I'll just pause it there for a sec. But this is the Adam. That's the call to prayer. Now, when they actually do respond to the call to prayer, what are they reciting?
Well, the first thing that before they even get to the point where they start praying, there is quite a lot of preparation that they have to do. I don't know if you particularly want to cover that right now, but they need to make sure that they're appropriately dressed. They need to make sure that they are clean, which means they have to go through a ritual of purity, which is normally called, I think, wudu, although it has got a couple of other names. Tayammum or ghusl, I think, are the alternative pronunciations. Excuse me, Arabic speakers, if I don't pronounce those absolutely correctly. I'm not a native Arabic speaker, so I apologize in advance. And they have to make sure they're facing the right direction, as you say, facing what's called the Qibla, which is the direction of the Kaaba in Mecca. And they have to be aware of what they're doing as well. That's an important thing. You can't just go to prayer and not know what you're doing. You have to be aware of what you're doing. That state of awareness is important, and it's one of the six elements that make the prayer valid. The reference I'm looking here refers to it as confidence of the time of worship, and you have to be doing it at the right time, in the right way, knowingly. Which is to say, if you have some sort of disease of the mind, for example, you are excused from prayer. If you don't know what you're doing because of a mental condition, you are excused from prayer. But you have to make sure you're wearing the appropriate clothes. Those clothes have got to be clean. You have to be cleaned in a ritual of purity, The place of worship itself ought to be clean, and if any of those things aren't fulfilled, then the prayer is not valid, and you would have to do it again. But when they actually come to prayer, and when they say the prayer, you're absolutely you were referring before to the fact that there are five prayers during the course of the day, and in each of these five prayers, each salat is made up of a number of rakats, which are words and actions, a group of words and actions that make up a rakat. Now, depending on the prayer, whether it's the Fajr sunrise prayer, the Zuhr noon prayer, the Asr afternoon prayer, the Maghrib evening prayer, or the Isha sunset prayer, the number of rakats varies, and there are some rakats which are considered to be obligatory for everybody, and they vary between 2 and 4 rakats in number over the course of the five prayers, and in total over the course of the five prayers that makes up a total of 17 obligatory rakats. That's a group of words and actions which are repeated over and over. There are also some voluntary rakats which can be completed under certain circumstances, which I won't go into right now. But when you start to look into what actually makes up the prayer, this is where it really starts to get interesting, because what they're saying is they ask, amongst other things, to be guided along the straight path. Okay, fair enough. You might think that's a good thing. And I can't find the specific reference, so I'm going to do this from memory. Part of the prayer says they pray to Allah to be guided along the straight path. Fair enough, so they can do good and not do evil. But to not be guided along the path of those who have been led astray, or those who have incurred Allah's wrath. Now that is a reference to Jews and Christians. I believe that the path along which those have been led astray, it refers to the Christians, and those who have incurred Allah's wrath refers to the Jews. And there is again, there are references which confirm this, and I would think that most Muslims who speak Arabic and English are aware of what the mm-hmm. implication is. But I'm sure there will be some Muslims, as you say, who repeat it by rote, who won't actually understand the implication. The fact that those who have lost their way refers to Christians, and that those who have incurred Allah's wrath refer to Jews. And in fact, this is effectively a curse upon the Christians and Jews 17 times a day. And that's slightly worrying, you might say, because is one of the first things that they have to learn. The Salat is taught to young children from the age of about 7 years old, and by the time they get to about 10 years old, I think this is certainly true of Muslim males, I'm not sure if it's exactly the same for females, but certainly true for Muslim males, by the time they're about 10 years old, they are expected to be performing Salat themselves. So when you start off your introduction to Islamic prayer, and those are the things you have to repeat 17 times a day, pretty soon it's going to be ingrained into you. And if you don't know it, don't understand it straight away, I'm sure your next door neighbour praying to you, when I say next door neighbour, I mean the person praying to you next to you in the mosque or wherever you might happen to be, I'm sure he's going to, there'll be at some point where you'll say, what does this actually mean? And he'll say, this is what it means. And somebody somewhere will probably say that it's a curse upon the Jews and the Christians, and it's a supplication to Allah for you to be led down the right path and not the wrong path of these two other groups. So right away you've got an us and them situation, which of course is reinforced at other times by other aspects of the Islamic ideology. I'm sure our listeners are pretty much all aware that the Islamic ideology is very much us and them, with the world being divided into Darul Islam, the lands that are ruled by Islamic rule, and Darul Harb, the lands that are not ruled by Islamic rule, and with which devout Muslims must therefore be at war until such time as they are ruled by Islamic rule. So that is one of the first introductions a young Muslim child will get to Islam, the Islamic prayer, which is effectively cursing the Jews and Christians 17 times a day.
And I'm just looking at the chart here when you were talking about the rakat, and in the Fajr, they have various rakat that must be recited, in the Zuhr, different, varying, like they're varying amounts, 4 rakat for the Asr, 3 rakat for the Maghrib, Isha, 4 rakat. It seems to me, Tim, that this is a very, very complicated procedure that they go through, and they do this 5 times a day.
It is complicated, and I suppose there is a reason for that, and especially with the congregational prayer, that when you repeat things over and over a large number of times a day in conjunction with other people, a strong bond forms between you all. I mean, that's something that's been known from time immemorial, and one of the obvious examples I can think of here is when you're doing military training and you're doing drills on a drill ground pretty much every army in the world does this, and the reason they do it is not because it's necessary for men to march in formation and to do the various manoeuvres information on the battlefield. They do it because it builds up a bond between those men, and so when they do have to actually go out in the field and fight, that bond actually helps them as a group on the battlefield. And it's not too dissimilar when you're talking about prayer of this nature. The more complex it is, the knowledge that you're doing it in conjunction with lots of other people and they're all doing it exactly the same way forms a very strong bond between Muslims. That of course has all sorts of other implications, because it means that when Muslims have this strong bond between them, they can be persuaded to do things as a group, which they might not necessarily do individually. Again, I'm going back to the analogy with military drill. The idea is that if you do enough drill and you eventually accomplish pretty much everything. A soldier needs to be able to act almost without thinking when he's on the battlefield, and that's a good thing because his life might depend on it. How well he's trained might at some point determine whether he lives or dies in a battlefield situation. And if he doesn't have to think but he just does what he's been trained to do, that could be a good thing. And you've got a similar situation where Muslims go through lots of complex procedures in order to follow these prayers 17 times a day. That's not the only thing they do, of course. Islam being such a highly regulated system, there are all sorts of things they have to do in their life, and they do it. They do them knowing that pretty much every other Muslim does those things in exactly the same way, and it builds up a bond. The disadvantage, of course, is that you can persuade such a group of people to do things which might be totally at odds with what we would consider to be a righteous moral compass. And it's not unknown, of course, for Muslims to pour out of the mosque on a Friday lunchtime in some countries if there's a particular situation they might have a grievance about, or the local Muslim community might have a grievance about. It doesn't take a great deal for an imam to instill a sense of hatred towards non-Muslims to the point where they'll all boil out of the mosque after Friday prayers and start slaughtering every non-Muslim in sight.
Absolutely. And I have a sound clip about that. Yeah. A little later on, Tim, I'll play that for the listeners. I have a sound clip for that. It's I'll have to do the translation, but I have the video, the YouTube link here, and I can play that later and read it later on for the listeners. But you're right, absolutely. There is absolutely no reason why not the imam can preach hatred towards the infidel or the kafir, as it were. Something else about the kafir. Kafirs, they were originally Christian blacks. Don't know if you knew that. I found that interesting. Arabics, they have a very low opinion of people of color, of course.
The word I was thinking of was reserved for the black man. That's an interesting thing, because I thought kuffar in particular just referred to disbeliever. I do know. It may or may not be related. Maybe one of our listeners can tell us that the word, there's a word in that's used to be used anyway. I don't know if it's used so much now in South Africa, where the white Boers used to refer to the natives in South Africa as kafir, I think, and that was a derogatory term because of the colour of their skin. But I wasn't sure how closely it was related to kufar. So that's actually quite interesting, because I did think kufar just meant disbeliever, but originally it was to do with colour, was it?
Mm-hmm.
All right. There you go, listeners. You learn something new every day. Even your humble host learns something new every day. So that's great.
When I was doing a little bit of research for the program today, I came across that, and I found that rather interesting.
Yeah. I mean, we do know that in Islam there is a, I won't say hierarchy exactly, but a pecking order insofar as the darker skinned that you are, the more a Muslim will look down on you. That is part and parcel of Islam. No matter how much they tell you that Islam is not racist, the fact is that the darker skin, even darker skinned Muslims, such as in Sudan, are looked down on by the lighter skin Arab Muslims. And of course, they all look down on the Christians, but that there is this factor of light and dark skin that goes back to the time of Muhammad. And Muhammad himself, if you look at some of the things he did and said, they would be termed racist without a doubt today, because he did make derogatory remarks about people with dark skin. Ethiopians, I think he had a special place in his heart for, with one or two of his sayings. And of course, the word for a slave, I think, in Arabic is abid or abd, and that refers primarily to black slaves. Am I right when I say that, Kel? I know there is a correlation.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
The skin colour and the fact that Muslims looked down on them to the point where they would enslave them, and they would treat them quite differently, purely on the skin colour, and that's as true today as it was then. And for those black people who are thinking about joining Islam, who might be listening now, it's worth bearing in mind that although your friendly local Muslim might say that everybody is treated the same in Islam, it ain't so. They do look down on people because of the colour of their skin, as well as looking down on them if they're not Muslim. There is also that skin colour factor. So that's another thing worth bearing in mind. But that's really interesting about the kuffar aspect, Kel. I wasn't aware of that, so thank you for that.
Oh, yeah. Pardon me. And Angry Mom, you cannot see the chat room, but we have quite a few people here, and Angry Mom being one of them. And she just put a link in the chat room, and it is pertaining to the racism against black Muslims, in particular by Arabs. And this is something that I have espoused quite a bit. Arabs still have slaves. They still have black slaves.
Indeed.
And
yes.
The link that she put in, I was perusing it. I found it rather interesting. I might even want to share that right now. It's only 2 minutes long, Tim.
Okay. You can tell there, can you, that I'm not able to see the chat room, because I can't see the chat room, but that fact is visible to you, is it? Because I was going to mention
it
in case you didn't know. Okay, that's good. Well, it's not good, but it's good that you know. by all means, Kel.
Let's take a look at this. And it's from Memory TV, so I'm going to have to do the translation, but let's take a look and see what we have here. And this is from Angry Mom. Thank you so much, Angry Mom. This is racism towards black Muslims in Iraq. So let's see what we have here. TV report on black people in Iraq. People still call them slaves in an age in which the world's loftiest palaces have collapsed. Their great suffering include many forms of oppression of men by their fellow men, who uses them as tools. They were not permitted to own land and used to work for the feudalists. They constitute a substantial percentage of Iraqi society. Most of them live in Basra in South Iraq. The blacks were and still are marginalized and excluded from society and politics. Blacks are still viewed as inferior slaves. This view has been passed down through generations. A black person is viewed as someone of lesser value, of lesser importance, as if he were a useless object which nobody considers important. Even politicians, writers, and researchers pay no attention to black people and their issues. People call me slave or black. There is no respect, no appreciation. Who is responsible for this? The large family. Take, for example, those children. They chase you, calling you black and whatever. It's not nice. What do you call white people? What do white people usually call you? They always call us slaves. They still do. The most common thing, and I get this all the time, is that when there is an argument with them, they immediately go, "Go away, you slaves. We are all the slaves of Allah." The only thing they know how to say is, "Go away, you slaves." Yesterday, I came from Baghdad, and when it was my turn to get in, the driver said, "Not only are you black, but you're also trying to push ahead. What is this? Is your God white and mine black?" I'm surprised people use such terms. When Obama won the elections, we began to hope that one day we would have a black president, not necessarily the president of the country, but a black official of any position that would protect and endorse us. So I thought that was interesting.
Yes, and of course you're forever being told by Muslims how Islam treats everybody equally. Well, I say forever being told. People in authority in Western countries are being told these things, and they believe them and they repeat them. And then they castigate people like you and me and our listeners when we try and correct them and say, well, in fact, Islam is one of the most racist groups on the planet. In fact, I'd go so far as to say there's nobody more racist than a devout Muslim. If he follows the example of the Prophet Muhammad, he's almost certainly going to be racist towards people who are darker skinned than he is, whether he tells you different or not. And that's just one example of it. So it's something that you would have thought if Islam is such a perfect example if the Prophet Muhammad was such a wonderful example of conduct, as Quran 33:10, I believe, says, and Islam is such a perfect religion, as we're forever being told, you would have thought that simple things like skin colour, which after all are something that nobody can control, it's part of your DNA, you have absolutely no control of it, and it's absolutely wrong that you should treat people discriminately purely because of your skin color, and yet Islam incorporates it. So just on that alone, I think it's very hard to argue that Islam has any moral goodness, certainly when it comes to discrimination between groups of people who have no control over the reason they're being discriminated against. But then that's just me. I'm old-fashioned.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Like, this is interesting that we didn't expect to touch upon this topic, but I'm glad we did, because it does bring up what we are discussing, what exactly goes on when they are praying towards Mecca five times a day. What exactly are they reciting, and what are they saying against us? And I do have a sound clip I'm going to share with you guys in a moment, Tim and myself. But it's interesting that we took a sidebar, and we are bringing up the issue of the kafir or kafir, depending on your saliva or salaba, however you want to pronunciate, I suppose. And we did touch upon this. It's fascinating. Islam is the true onion. When you peel back a layer, boy, oh boy, oh boy, there are so many more to unpeel. Islam is the gift that keeps on giving, unfortunately, and this is just one other aspect of Islam. They're racist.
Well, quite so. The gift that keeps on giving. I like that. I'm going to incorporate that somewhere. I'm not sure where yet, but it's a very good, it's a very good analogy. It is a little like an onion, and it's one of the reasons that I suppose that Muslims have been so successful in pulling the wool over the eyes of the people who need to have their, from a Muslim point of view, you need to be able to pull the wool over the eyes of the kuffar, especially those of the kuffar who are in authority in the countries that you are trying to invade and colonize and take over, until such time as there are enough Muslims to render that exercise unnecessary. And they have been I have to say, quite successful in what they have done and how they have done it, because Islam being like an onion, as you say, a lot of people take a look at it and they think, oh, this is really just too difficult to get my head around. I'll just believe what Muslims tell me about it and then I'll go away and worry about something else. Fast forward a generation or two ahead and they wonder why their country has been taken over and reduced to a pile of rubble, such as, well, Lebanon is the one in most recent memory that I like to refer to, because that's exactly what happened, a majority Christian country in the Middle East, where, for reasons best known to themselves, and I still haven't delved into the Islamic history of the past 100 years or so to give a definitive reason for this, but they allowed the number of Muslims in that country to build up to a tipping point, and no doubt the Muslims in that country were giving it large, as we say over here, saying that Islam is a religion of peace and you don't need to worry yourselves about exactly what we do with our prayers and so on. You just let us get on with it. And within a generation or two, Lebanon was plunged into civil war, and the outcome now is it's a majority Muslim country with all the non-Muslim and Christian persecution that we've come to expect from Muslims whenever they get the chance to perform it. So, yeah, it's just another of those cautionary tales, I suppose, of what happens if you don't pay enough attention to what Muslims do and say when they first start to build up a significant population in your country. And of course, in every Western country in the world now, this is what we are seeing to a greater or lesser degree.
Absolutely, we are. We're going to take a break in a little moment, and but I do have something here, and I'm going to play this clip in a moment, but I want to give Tim a chance to refresh his tea and give you ladies and gentlemen a chance to do likewise, whether it be a tea, a coffee, a cola you want to grab out of the fridge or anything like that. But I have this, Tim.
Ashhadu an la ilaha illallah. أشهد أن لا إله إلا الله أشهد أن محمد رسول الله
Shut up! Oh my God, I don't care!
I tell you what, that's one of the best. That's one of the best ringtones, Kel, I have heard in a long time.
Mike Holt. He has probably one of the very best openings on Blog Talk Radio
that we put together
for his show. Yeah. Oh, actually, no. I'm sorry. It's his closing. It's part of his closing song. It's just brilliant in that they have the call to prayer, and then you hear the gunshot, and then you hear the Australian national anthem.
Yeah, that's rather amusing. That's rather amusing, and I think there's a similar one where they have the call to prayer followed by the rattle of gunshots and the U.S. national anthem as well.
And there's one for Canada as well.
Yeah, I think that should catch on as a ringtone. Mind you, if you did it over here, you know, that is to say in the U.K., you could actually find yourself, believe it or not, in trouble. One of the things I had occasion to research... for some reason that escapes me now, are some of the things that can result in a charge of religiously aggravated harassment. I can't think why I was researching that, so it's just one of those things. But anyway, one of the things that we had here in the UK not so very long ago was a chap who was... I say he was minding his own business. I think he was in a shop and his mobile phone went off. And it was somebody on the mobile phone as a ringtone was talking in a Pakistani accent. And it was a clip from a movie, nothing very terrible, nothing particularly derogatory, but it was in a Pakistani accent. So anyway, a Pakistani woman standing near to him took offence at this, called the local constabulary, and the man was charged with religiously aggravated harassment and actually spent some time in jail for what he had on his ringtone. So here in the UK, you have to be quite careful about things like that. So there's a little cautionary tale for any of our listeners who have such a ringtone on their phone and who are thinking of visiting the UK on their holidays. If that ringtone goes off in the wrong place at the wrong time in front of the wrong person, you could find yourself with a little bit of explaining to do. And that's our politically correct multicultural environment that we have over here at the moment. So just thought I'd throw that in, Kel.
Interesting, Tim. Very, very interesting. We're going to take a very short break. And when we come back, I am going to play a sound clip and translate for you. Tim and I are going to deconstruct that. But, Tim, I also want you to share the news that is going on with you in particular coming up in February, if you're so willing to do so.
Yes, it's just a little a brief bit of news. I was visited last month by the local constabulary here after a complaint by a certain Fiaz Mughal. Now, Fiaz Mughal, for those of our listeners who don't know him, is a member of the British establishment. He must at least at one time have been quite well thought of because he's been awarded an OBE, which is the Order of the British Empire. It's an honour which I think is presented to individuals by the Queen for things that they do in the community, which are generally perceived to be a good thing. Anyway, Fiaz Mughal runs an organisation called Tell Mama UK, and he trawls through this organisation. He trawls the internet looking for people who are saying nasty things about Muslims or about Islam. All well and good, you might say, because we don't want people saying nasty things about Muslims or Islam now, do we? Well, anyway, in order to perform this most worthy task, he is assigned, or he used to be assigned, a large sum of money every year from the British taxpayer, given to him by the Department of Communities and Local Government over here, the DCLG, several hundred thousand pounds every year, so that he could go and trawl the internet, Twitter and Facebook and so on, and find all these nasty things that were allegedly being said about Islam and Muslims. Bear with me on this. Anyway, it was found in June last year that the worthy Fiaz Mughal obviously wasn't getting quite enough of these online hate crimes as he would have liked. In fact, he was falling short, really, of what he needed to justify his enormous hundreds of thousands of pounds every year from the British taxpayer. So he did what any good Muslim would do. He started fraudulently manipulating the statistics for Tell Mama UK. And he must have thought that he was doing quite well with it, because I think he did it over the course of more than 1 year. Unfortunately for him, there were some people who were independently checking these figures, the Association of Chief Police Officers, ACPO, as it's known over here. And they called him in and they said, "Your figures don't stack up." At which point, Fiaz Mughal got rather irate, threw all his toys out of the pram and stormed out of the meeting. Anyway, after further research, it was found, yep, he'd definitely been fraudulently manipulating the statistics and misrepresenting the entire picture to the Department of Communities and Local Government, and his funding was stopped. Oh, shock horror. Anyway, this was all picked up by the Daily Telegraph, which is one of the mainstream newspapers over here, and they broadcast the whole sorry story. So how does this affect yours truly? Well, I'll tell you. When I read this report in the Telegraph, I was more than offended. I was outraged. I was more than outraged.
Oh, I know. Absolutely. Like, what do you do? You're sitting there, and you're taking this in, and you're being you're being confronted with this for what,
yeah.
calling him out for what he was, and we know exactly what he was.
I called him, amongst other things, a mendacious, grievance-mongering, a taqiyya artist, and a lying Muslim scumbag, at which point he decided he didn't really like what I was saying, and he decided to set the dogs on me, and consequently, my case comes up next month. And that might have had something to do with the reason I was researching racially and religiously aggravated harassment that we were talking about before. That might have had something to do with it, if truth be told. But there is a larger issue here, because, this is potentially quite a serious offence. It carries, if you're found guilty, it carries prison time. Which I can't say I'm particularly looking forward to, but I think that the bigger issue here is what actually, where are the boundaries of free speech leading us at the moment? Is it the case that you cannot call somebody out for obviously lying about their conduct while in public office or while performing a so-called public service when they're appropriating hundreds of thousands of taxpayers, hundreds of thousands of pounds in taxpayers' money? Are you just not allowed to call them out, or have you got to be a little more circumspect in your speech? I called him mendacious. Well, he's certainly mendacious. I called him a Muslim. Well, he's certainly a Muslim. I called him a scumbag. Well, that's my term for people who steal money from the taxpayer while fraudulently manipulating the statistics. So as far as my definition is concerned, I was absolutely right in calling him what I did. Whether, of course, that's going to be a sufficiently good defence when I come up in front of the magistrates next month remains...
Yeah.
But that is the story, Kel. That is the story.
And there you go. And your case comes up February 18th.
Indeed.
And I've put a couple of links in the chat room for people. And we're going to take a musical break, but Tim and myself, we do really much appreciate, very much appreciate the people that are taking time out of their busy day to join us and... Tim,
yes,
we have Angry Mom 80, C. Robert Jones, that's my Dr. Jones. We have Cat Form. We have some guests joining us. We have Luchadora 41. We have Moving Forward, No Way 90, Paul Alexander, Vito Esposito of Radio Jihad Network, and Ken McClinton of The Exceptional Conservative, and we have Sue from New Mexico. Joining us as well. We got ourselves a little full house going on here.
Nice to see you. Yeah, a full house. Excellent. Well, I'm sorry I can't see you all in the chat room, but I'm sure Kel will be keeping me apprised of anything that drops into the chat room, which we can then bring in and use in our conversation. So thank you all for being here, and you in particular, Sue, and we always like to see you whenever you drop in. All the other people, because I can't see them listed here, but thank you for being with us, and hope you'll stay with us till after the break, and we'll be able to tell you a little bit more, hopefully, about Islamic prayer and its implications for the rest of us.
Exactly. And with that, we will take a little bit of a break. It's a three-minute break. Guys, refresh your teas, your coffees, your beverages, whatever. And Tim and myself will see you back here in a little over 3 minutes. And hey, Tim, you know what?
Mm-hmm.
When I first met you, you were a guest on the Red Fox Blogger. I am eternally grateful that now you are the co-host on the Monday program. When you first came on, I found this song, and I'm going to replay it just for you, Tim.
Okay.
To bring you around. But when you need your outlook changed, baby, I'm the cat. Baby, I'm allowed to be late when I'm coming home. You know I'll be there when I want you, and you let me roam. You think you've got me figured out, I don't know about that. But when you wanna twist and shout, baby, I'm the cat. Baby, I might not be all that your fortune cookie promised you, but I will do. I'm the cat. Baby, I'm the cat. Oh yeah.
To the Red Fox Blogger with your hosts Tim and Kel, and thank you all for being here, and also thank you all who listen in archive. Tim, yep, the Islamic call to prayer. I have something here that I wanted to share. I'm just going to put it on mute because I tend to get pop-ups when I do this, but okay, I didn't get a pop-up. I have something here. This is Tim and myself, we have been discussing, we've been dissecting the Islamic call to prayer, and what exactly are they saying? And I came across this clip, Tim, and this is Islam allows prayers for the annihilation of Christians and Jews. So I'm going to play that, and I'm going to recite it as well, because it is it needs translation. So here we go. This is from the Memory TV Project. And Memory TV, M-E-M-R-I TV Project, they are renowned for translating the dirty little secrets that the Islamists think that will never cross our desks. Well, thank God for Memory TV. This is Sheikh Dr. Ahmad Abd al-Latif. And he is a professor at the Al-Qura University in Saudi Arabia. This is going back quite a few years. This is from May of 2004. But believe me, it is timely. And I'm going to recite it to you. Here we go. Some imams and preachers call for Allah to annihilate the Jews and those who help them, and the Christians and those who also help them, and call for him not to leave a single survivor of them on this land. Is it permitted according to Islamic law? Now that was professor, quote unquote, is being interviewed. That was the question of the interviewer, and this is the professor's response. What made them curse the Jews is that the Jews are the oppressors. What they are doing to the Muslims and Palestinians is known and consists of oppression and tyranny. They destroy their homes and kill their women and children. This is why the question of whether it is permitted to pray against their annihilation, infidels and murderers. The same goes for the Christians, because of their cruel aggression against Islamic countries. Okay, but the question was about the call for their total annihilation. The answer is coming. The same goes for the curse against the Christians for what they do to the Muslims. The truth about them was revealed in Abu Ghraib prison. Their false culture was also revealed, as for their claims that they want to spread democracy. Well, the truth is that this is a crusading war whose goal is to harm Muslims. This is why a Muslim is allowed to curse the oppressors from among the Jews and the Christians. Of course, the question was about the annihilation of the Jews and those cursing the oppressing Jews and the oppressing and plundering Christians. And the prayer that Allah will annihilate them is permitted. And let me repeat that. And the prayer that Allah will annihilate them is permitted. In fact, the Prophet himself used to curse some oppressors. But if it is possible, people should pray that Allah guides the others. There is no need for anger to overcome us. That's interesting. We should not pray only for their annihilation and for Allah to take revenge on them. And the clip ended abruptly there. But that last part, here, I'm going to back it up a bit. There is no need for anger to overcome us. We should not pray only for their annihilation, but for Allah to take revenge upon them. Ta-da, Islamic prayer. There you go. So what exactly are they reciting every Friday there, or 5 days, or five times a day there, Tim?
Well, quite. If that is what is being taught in many mosques, then it's hardly surprising that we are seeing what we're seeing. And we referred earlier in the show to what happens on many Fridays after the Friday congregational prayer. In many countries, Muslims pour out of the mosque and they slaughter everybody in sight that they can see who is obviously not a Muslim, destroy their homes, destroy their businesses. This is a common thing. And where you have imams who routinely give prayers of that kind, given that the Muslim mindset is such that they do not employ a great deal of critical analysis when they listen to what is being said in the mosques. In fact, critical analysis is a component which is largely absent from the Muslim environment, as we probably know. It's hardly surprising to see them come out of the mosque in an absolutely inflamed state and start wreaking havoc. It's so easy to do when you have created the brainwashing, I suppose, is the term that you would use, through the routine of prayers five times a day, every day for a number of years. It's you condition the brain to accept certain things without question. And then if the imam throws something like that into the mix, highly inflammatory, it's hardly surprising that we see what we do. I really don't see any alternative to coming down very heavily on any imam who propagates such prayers in mosques or amongst any group of Muslims in any Western country. At the moment, we don't do it because we are so afraid of being called racist, bigoted, fascist, intolerant, anti-Muslim, Islamophobes. Mm-hmm. And the atmospherics, if you like, of political correctness and multiculturalism have been such that we have been too scared of our own shadow to really do anything constructive about it. But we are going to have to do something about it if we are not going to lose our civilization and our countries in the West. But that's just a prime example. That's just one example, I imagine, of amongst many, of an inflammatory sermon which is just designed to get Muslims going. And of course, a little bit of critical thought, if it were applied at this point, which it never is amongst Muslims listening to these things, but a little bit of critical thought would soon make you realise that, I mean, they're talking about what Christians have done invading Muslim countries. We wouldn't have needed to go in and, in quotation marks, invade Muslim countries had we not been attacked in the first place. And even going back a little bit further, you can look at pretty much the whole 1400-year history of Islam and see that it's a history of supremacism and conquest by the most ruthless, brutal methods that you can imagine. And that's been going on for 1400 years. And if there have been reactions by Christians as in the Crusades, which, of course, everybody has bought into the narrative that the Crusades were conducted by Christians who just woke up one day and thought, oh, I've got nothing better to do today, let's go and maybe slaughter a few thousand Muslims. It wasn't that at all. The Crusades, as we know, were in response to 400 years of Muslim aggression and conquest of previously Christian-occupied lands in the Middle East, which we finally responded to over a series of crusades in the 10th and 11th centuries. I haven't got the dates exactly. But the fact is that the Muslims routinely complain about the reason that Muslims employ these curses of annihilation upon the Christians is because Christians are so evil towards Muslims. Not a word, of course, about how the doctrine of Islamic expansionism and supremacism is the driving force behind all the interaction between Muslims and non-Muslims that has caused so much trouble for the last 1400 years. The Jews are another matter altogether, but of course it's worth just mentioning briefly that the animosity towards the Jews existed long before the State of Israel came into being, and long before the fictional State of Palestine was drawn up by the Arabs of the Middle East in order to create a stick with which to beat the Israelis and the rest of the Western countries. So obviously there is a lot more to the history than that, but of course what I'm getting at is that the Muslims that complain about the action of Christians and Jews as being justification for calling down Allah's curse upon them conveniently forget that, in fact, if it hadn't been for Islamic supremacism and the Arab doctrines of expansionism going back to the 6th, 7th century, we wouldn't have this problem at all.
Oh, and you were bringing up the Crusades, and yeah, I believe there were four Crusades, but one of the most prolific that stands out is the Crusade of the Siege of Vienna, and that one took place in 1683, and that was probably one of the most crucial Crusades because they were right there. They were right on the European doorstep. This was probably one of the most important Crusades that we had to face.
When we're talking about the Crusades, I was primarily referring to the Crusades that took place in the 10th and 11th century. But of course, Islamic expansionism being what it is, when they felt they were powerful enough again, as you say, in 1683, they decided they were going to try and take over Europe. And it was only the Polish king, Jan Sobieski, am I right, who stopped them at the gates of Vienna with his army and turned them back?
Right.
I hadn't actually classified that in my mind as a crusade specifically. It was turning back an advance of Arab armies, whereas the Crusades I was thinking about were retaliatory expeditions carried out by Christians in the 10th and 11th centuries in order to recapture lands which had been conquered over the previous 400 years by Muslims. But yeah, I mean, we're still looking at everything that Christians, especially in Europe, have done. You know, whether it's Jan Sobieski at the gates of Vienna in 1683 or Charles Martel turning back the Muslims at the Battle of Tours in 732. How's my history, Kel?
You're getting there.
Yeah, it's all a response to the Muslim aggression and the Muslim expansionism that's prompted by the Islamic doctrines, and which in turn have their roots in the Islamic prayers, which have been developed and refined ever since the time, well, I say refined, have been developed and used by pretty much every Muslim, developed and followed, I should say, by pretty much every Muslim since the time of Muhammad. So to say that Muslims are doing all these bad things now because it's in response to Christian and Jewish aggression is a little bit rich. I think most of our listeners would agree when I say that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I do know that I just brought up a wiki link, and I don't necessarily trust Wikipedia, but just for the sake of you know, not delving into all of the blogs that I could go to and scrolling down them. But the first crusade was near East Anatolia in Levant and Palestine, and that took place from 1096 to 1099.
Yeah, okay.
And that was in that France and Germany were trying to take back what the Muslim conquests were striving for, and that was taking the Holy Land.
Yes. Yes, that's what I was primarily referring to. When we were talking about the siege that ended at the gates of Vienna in 1683, I didn't actually have that in my mind as part of the Crusades. I mean, if in the references you're using, it's referred to as a crusade, then I apologize, but I didn't think that it was actually, it was more just a turning back of the Muslim expansionism that had taken place over the previous couple of hundred years. If that's still classified as part of the Crusades, then I apologize, because I hadn't actually included it as part of the
sequence. Because when they reached the gates of Vienna, they were beating them back, And like you say, you're right. It was a reaction to the invasion of the Moors, as it were. But the Gates of Vienna, I think that was a very, very important note to bring up, because I consider, like, I don't know if anybody else would, I think that historians would, in that it was indeed, it turned into a crusade. And
oh,
that,
yeah. Yeah, it was certainly a historical turning point, without a doubt, as was the turning back of the Muslims at the Battle of Tours in 732. And the only thing I was taking issue with was whether you would include it as part of the Crusades, which I had in my mind is restricted to the 10th and 11th century. But, I mean, it is all part and parcel of turning back Muslim expansionism, so I suppose to include it wouldn't be a bad thing, and maybe it's only an esoteric point that it doesn't really matter a great deal. But yeah, I mean, the point you make with the siege of the Gates of Vienna is that it was an extremely important point in Christian European history. Certainly as important as anything that was ever done during the Crusades of the 10th and 11th century. And I've lost my thread. Help me, Kel.
Oh, no. No, I did just want to interject the Siege of Vienna in there, because I think that historians would agree that this was part of a crusading movement to beat back the Moors, and that they were getting very, very close to conquest. And if it weren't for this particular historical conflict, that we would not be having this discussion today. It's because of the Siege of Vienna and the ensuing battle that took place that I think that the Siege of Vienna does deserve absolute recognition for what was accomplished there in keeping the Moors or the Muslims held at bay. And, of course, Suleiman the Magnificent, he thought for sure that he had it in the bag. Boy, was he ever in for a surprise, hey?
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. As you say, if it hadn't been all turned back at the Gates of Vienna, then the history of Europe would have been very different, and the outcome would have been almost certainly that Europe would now be a Muslim continent. So what we're seeing today, of course, is really only a continuation of a very old battle. It's a new phase of a very old battle.
I'm just wondering, where do we go with this? Because it's interesting that we have been speaking about the Crusades. It's amazing. I think that we discussed what goes on within Islamic prayer, what goes on in the mosques, and now we're discussing the Crusades. I think this has been quite an interesting program. I want to ask you a question, though, about the mosques. Mm-hmm. I was in a chat room, and they were discussing what's going on in the mosques. And there was the usual, well, they should be shut down, and they should be at the very least monitored. I said, well, what would that accomplish, monitoring the mosques? They'll just take it further underground. If we're going to monitor the mosques, they can't know. But the imam, he gets up there and he riles up all of these adherents, his co-religionists, and they walk out of the Friday prayers, for example, and they seem to be very, very scowly. What exactly is the imam teaching in these mosques, and how do we monitor them without them actually knowing? And I'm wondering, in the United States, we would probably be violating their First Amendment, because that's freedom of speech, of course. In England, I imagine, it's the same. Canada, I know that we would be up for some sort of violation if we're monitoring, because technically it's private property. These mosques are our private property. So if we go in and we monitor these mosques, whether it not be with CCTV or whatever it is, but how do we control what these mosques are teaching the adherents?
Well, yeah, you raise a very good point there, Kel, because with any in any Western society where you have got, let me go back a step. In Western societies, before we had the problem that we had with Muslims, we recognized that there were going to be certain institutions that would need to be regulated and licensed and monitored, whether it was, places that sold alcohol, places that allowed gambling. We recognized that because of human nature, there was going to be a need to regulate and license and monitor certain places in order to have an orderly society. And most people accepted that. And the reason that most people accepted that is that, by and large, amongst non-Muslim groups of people in most Western countries, there existed a common bond of trust. And Trust is a very fundamental issue in any civilization that you have. If you go out of your door in the morning, go off to work, you're trusting that you're not going to get robbed as soon as you go out the door. You're not going to get beaten or shot. Most of the time, your trust is well placed. There are forces of law and order that exist to monitor the streets to make sure that those things don't happen. And it's a hallmark of a civilized society that this level of trust exists and works fairly well amongst most groups. And where you've got places that sell alcohol or gambling or where there is gambling taking place or any kind of activity which, if left to itself, would almost certainly get out of control, most people accept that there's a need for regulation, licensing and monitoring, and by and large that works well. There's always going to be a few bad apples who try and bend the rules, but a few bad apples in a civilization of millions of people can be controlled, so it's not a huge deal. But when you introduce Muslims into the equation, the paradigm again changes fundamentally, because the level of trust that you can possibly have in between Muslims and non-Muslims is at best compromised and at worst non-existent. And the reason for that is because Muslims are taught that as we were going back to the prayers that we were talking about right at the start, Muslims are taught that the world is divided into them and us, and that it is a Muslim's duty to do whatever they can in whatever way they can to further the cause of Islam in ways large and small, which is why you see the disruption of meatpacking plants by Muslims who want to throw their weight around with their prayers, and why you see Muslims suing left, right, and centre for the minor transgressions that they experience, and if they're slightly offended, it's an occasion for a lawsuit, and if you go out of your way to call a Muslim a mendacious, grievance-mongering taqiyya artist or a lying Muslim scumbag, he's likely to set the dogs on you. I can't think why I thought of that particular example, but there you go. But the point is that there's an issue of trust here, and when you have Muslims in Western society, that trust does not exist on the same level. So when we talk about regulation and licensing and monitoring, although those would be good things if we could expect the majority of Muslims to abide by the Kufar's laws in those respects, in practice they are unlikely to abide by the Kufar laws, and you can certainly see the possibility that if they know that their mosque is being monitored, or if they're if they want to conduct themselves in the way that they would expect to conduct themselves in a mosque, they'll go underground, like you say. If there's CCTV, you can bet your boots they will damage the CCTV hardware so it can't be used, or they'll conduct themselves out of range of the CCTV cameras, because mosques are not. Much as we would like to monitor and regulate and license them, they are not religious institutions in the way that we would regard a church or a synagogue as a religious institution. They are command and control centers. They are there for the sole purpose of promoting Islam at the expense of the kuffar. And so while there might be people who say... the first step should be registration and monitoring and licensing of mosques. In a sane world where we all trusted each other more or less to the same extent, that might be a reasonable thing to do. But the fact is that with anything that involves Muslims, where you haven't got that level of trust, or it's compromised at best, or it doesn't exist at all at its very worst, you cannot simply rely on Muslims following the rules. You might say, yeah, there's got to be regulation, licensing and monitoring, but they will then go out of their way to avoid the consequences of such registration, licensing and monitoring, and the problem will not be solved. So I'm afraid... we are, if we're going to deal with this problem at all, we are going to have to take much more draconian steps than we would otherwise if we didn't have Muslims involved. And it's sad to say, but that's the reality of the situation.
Exactly.
And for that reason.
And I have something that I want to share, and I've been saying this for a very, very long time. Like, I am by no means, ladies and gentlemen, I am by no means a scholar. Tim just makes me look smarter than what I actually am. There has been something I've been espousing for a couple of years now, and that is Islam has to be recognized for what it is. It's not a religion. It's a political ideology. And one thing that we must insist our politicians do is de-index Islam as a protected status religion and stop the funding of the mosques and stop building the mosques. Tim says draconian. That doesn't even begin to cover it for me, Tim. I am so fed up with this that these are hotbeds of terrorism. These are hotbeds, and Vito Esposito brought up in the chat room a little while back, and I'm going to see if I cannot collect it. But they're devout Muslims. They're teaching dominance and superiority. These are what they're teaching in the mosques in the West. It is time that, and that brings me back full circle to how do we monitor what is being taught in these mosques. What's going on in these mosques, the Friday prayers for specifically. And when I was speaking with Jeff of East Anglian EDL radio show, he was relating a story to me where he was sitting on the coach. And it was stopped at a red light, and it happened to be in front of a mosque. And they were spilling out. And he said that the men, they looked so grim and red-faced and angry. And... When we go to our places of worship Sunday morning or Saturday, if you're Jewish, you come out and you feel so much better about yourselves, and you stand around afterwards and you talk to your fellow congregants. It's a great moving experience. But this particular political entity disguised in a religion, what they're doing in these mosques, I have no idea. Well, I do have an idea. We all have an idea. We're not stupid. But they come out and they just seem more determined. And I noticed that in the Middle East, Tim, that they seem so hyped up. They create so many acts of violence on Fridays.
Well, yes, they do. And for the reasons that we described earlier, that the whole worldview is built around the fact an us and them worldview. There are Muslims, and in their mind, the Muslims are the only people worthy of any kind of respect at all. And then there's everybody else, and everybody else is there only to be conquered, subjugated, converted, or ultimately killed. And while they might say, okay, well, we won't kill them today, we'll just see how today goes and see how we get on, you cannot get away from the fact that the mindset of most of the Muslims out there is set to dividing the world into those two parts, us and them. And if you reinforce that often enough with the five times a day prayer, which translates to 17 rakat over five salat, and you're cursing the Jews and Christians in every one of those, that has to have an effect on your relationship as an individual with the non-Muslims you see around you. And of course, in a group, if you get an imam who is inclined or inspired to wind these people up, you will get a very strong reaction, because the critical analysis that most of us employ when we decide what we're going to do in a given situation, that is just not present. They go straight to violence without any real thought at all, on a hair trigger, as it were, at the slightest pretext. And of course, you referred to, wouldn't it be nice if our political elites recognised the reality of the situation and reclassified Islam as a political ideology rather than a religion? Well, if they did that, then an awful lot of the problems that seem intractable at the moment would suddenly become very, it would be very easy to understand and to deal with those problems. The only reason that we don't deal with them effectively is because Islam has this religious protection, which it doesn't deserve in the slightest. And we really need to take that away from them. And then once we do that, we can see that the actions of Muslims who behave in this way are not just criminal, they border on sedition and treason. And we can say that if there are circumstances which lead up to making them like that, then we are then in a much better position to attack the causes of that at a much more grassroots level. So, we sequester and confiscate all the mosques, preferably reallocating them for worthy non-Muslim uses. I've already suggested pig races on Fridays, which I think, you know, that would be a worthy activity to hold in a mosque that had been sequestered or confiscated. But yeah, I mean, that's just one aspect. If you take away the religious protection and say that if you choose to remain as a Muslim, you are going to be treated very, very differently, and you will not enjoy religious protection. We may say to you that you are allowed to believe in your own mind what you want, and if you wish to perform a prayer or series of prayers in your own time, in your own house, behind closed doors, well, that's entirely up to you. But if you display any kind of behavior which we would consider to be antisocial, criminal, seditious or treasonous in public, you will be dealt with far more severely than you would compared to whether you're a non-Muslim. And we could actually say that being criminal while Muslim should be an aggravating circumstance. We talked earlier about religiously aggravated harassment. Well, pretty much any sort of crime committed by a Muslim could be referred to as a Muslim aggravated crime, and there would be justification for it, because the teachings that go on in these mosques at the moment lead Muslims to believe that their law, Sharia law, is superior to the law of the country they happen to reside in. Now, that is not a situation which you can allow to continue if you want to retain your country and retain your civilization. You have to get to a point where you say, our laws are paramount. if you break them, and we find that you break them because of your particular worldview, then you are going to have to be treated very differently, and we are going to make it so difficult for you to continue to practice Islam in the way you would like to practice in our country, that you would find that you would be far happier going back to an Islamic country where these things are allowed. And if we can make it
exactly.
we will go a long way towards solving the problem.
Tim, you won't believe this. We're down to our last 5 minutes.
Oh, I can't believe it. It seems like only a couple of minutes ago we started talking.
Know. I told you this last week. This is probably the fastest 2 hours I spend.
Yeah. It's absolutely
but
shot time.
Before we close out, I want to allow you, I mean, it's your show too, but you're going to be on the Audrey Russo show this week, perhaps?
Oh, indeed,
and
yes.
And that is real fun?
It is. It's the Audrey Russo show. I think, what's she called? Real Talk Radio, I think she calls it. And that's at 6:30 Eastern Time on Thursday, 6:30 in the evening. So that'll be 11:30 GMT on Thursday evening on the Audrey Russo show. Yes, I'm highly privileged. Kel was speaking to Audrey Russo a few days ago and very kindly gave her my details, and Audrey Russo got in touch with me, and she said, can I have a photograph of you? So I thought, oh, yeah, no problem at all. So I sent her a photograph, and she said, can I have a bio? And I thought, well, what can I possibly tell her? I made a couple of things up. I didn't really make them up. It's absolutely true. I told her I was 61, that I had a black belt in Japanese martial arts, that I played country and western and bluegrass on the guitar and Scots-Irish folk music, and that I occasionally appeared on the Red Fox blogger blog talk radio show, where I was affectionately described as an opinionated son of a bitch. So I don't know what Audrey thinks of me. She's probably going to.
She's probably wondering, what did Kel send my way?
That's probably exactly right. So, yes, anybody who's
well,
got,
you know what? What I'll make sure I do is that when you send me the link, when Audrey has the tee up ready, you'll send it my way so
I can
ensure that it gets onto the Red Fox blogger, because, Tim, what you're going through right now is unbelievably unreal. I cannot believe that you will be taken to court.
Yes, I know. It quite surprised me. But the way I look at it is it's an opportunity to further our cause. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, an acquittal or a conviction is not the big issue here. The big issue is the much greater issue of freedom of speech and what we are allowing to happen in Western countries when Muslims get mildly offended. They are in a position where they can call out the big guns in terms of law enforcement and so on to get redress. That's entirely wrong in my view, and I'm certainly prepared to argue that in court. But there's also the other issue that we touched on earlier, which is the basic issue of trust between Muslims and non-Muslims. I call this particular individual a grievance-mongering taqiyya artist and called him mendacious and a lying Muslim scumbag. And I did so for reasons that, I'm quite prepared to argue in court. And the very fact that I called him both mendacious and Muslim in the same sentence comes down to the Islamic practice of taqiyya, where it is quite permissible to lie in the cause of Islam.
Yeah.
If it furthers the cause of Islam, you can lie your little Muslim socks off with a clear conscience, even if you are in a British court of law under oath. And that's a very, very important point that our political elites are trying very hard to gloss over. But it's a crucial factor in the case that I'm about to come up in.
Tim, the English lady is speaking to us.
Uh-huh.
That English lady said we have 60 seconds.
I'm so sorry. I've been going on, and I haven't even given you...
No, Tim, it's absolutely fine. Oh, my goodness. Another fantastic show we had, I feel, today. Tim, I will be speaking with you very soon.
Certainly will, Kel. We'll Skype together sometime in the next couple of days. And in the meantime, I'd like to thank all our listeners for joining us tonight and hope you'll join us next week. And certainly, if you get a chance, listen to Audrey Russo's show on Thursday night at 6:30 Eastern Time.
Ladies and gentlemen, we want to thank you all so very much for joining us. I'll see you back here where I fly solo on Friday at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And remember,
massive, it's massive slammer.
And remember, that's all they got. Well, it is mass islamity, and we have to stop the insanity. Well, the archive listeners will get that. Oh, we're into archive. Oh, Tim, it was fantastic.
Yeah, it worked really well. I was really pleased with the way it all came together. Because I did think when I first started researching it, I thought, oh well, you know, what are we going to say? But when I started having done a little bit of research, it's actually quite a lot. And then you can add up and expand on them and bring in all sorts of additional related subjects. So it all worked really well and it all really hung together well. So I was really pleased with that. Yeah, an excellent show. another triumph for the Red Fox blogger, I say. So,
and there you go. Hey, are you available for a quick Skype?
Yeah, certainly. When are you thinking? What, right now or what? Or what?
Yeah, I'm going to close out the show, and I want to have a word with you. I've got some very exciting news to share with you.
Yeah, no worries at all. Close the show out. Give me a call back as soon as you're ready.
You betcha. And for the archive listeners, thank you all very much for joining Tim and myself. We will be back together on Monday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time, 8 p.m. Greenwich Mean Time. And like I say, the Red Fox flies solo at 7 p.m. Eastern Time right here on Blog Talk Radio. Guys, once again, mass islamity, stop the insanity. Tim, I'll talk to you
yes,
soon.
All right. Okay. Good night, Kel, and good night, everybody.
Good night, everybody. Good night, Tim.
أشهد أن لا إله إلا الله أشهد أن لا إله إلا الله أشهد أن محمد رسول الله
Shut up! Oh my God, I don't care!